Hi, this is David Moorfield from LearnToBuyCryptocurrency.com. And in this episode, I'm actually talking to my father, who's an economics professor, and asking him to explain quantitative easing and how it affects our money supply, the value of the dollar, and our economy overall.
Okay, I'm Roger Moorfield. I'm a professor of economics at the University of St. Thomas in Houston.
All right. And one of the things that I had asked if maybe you could explain to listeners is what exactly is quantitative easing?
Okay. Well, first, a little background about our banking system. We have a fractional reserve banking system where when you deposit your money with your retail bank, they hold about 10% of it in reserve against your deposit, and they try to lend out the rest. And this process of lending out your money creates more money to circulate in the economy. Now, we also have a central bank in the U.S. called the Federal Reserve Bank, the Fed for short. And the Fed is a banker's bank. And the Fed is there to try to stabilize the economy, especially prices. So when the economy is faltering, what the Fed tries to do is to get the banks to lend more money. So as to stimulate the economy to keep it from contracting any further. Now, in the 07-09 recession, the so-called Great Recession, the economy began to contract, and so the first thing the Fed does is it takes action to cause interest rates to fall. And there is an interest rate that signals the rate at which banks borrow reserves from each other. They lend to and borrow from each other. And so if Bank A has excess reserves on deposit, Bank B needs some reserves to lend, then B will borrow from A, and the rate at which they borrow is the Fed funds rate. Now, this rate sort of signals the direction of monetary policy. And when it goes down, borrowing becomes cheaper, and businesses can borrow more for plant and equipment. Home buyers can borrow for homes, can more easily borrow for their homes, et cetera. Now, what happened in the 07-09 recession is that the Fed funds rate, this benchmark rate, went to practically zero. It was about between a quarter of a point and zero. And it still wasn't enough. Banks were not making additional loans to stimulate the economy as desired. So the Fed says, oh, we have this, it's called the so-called lower bound problem. Essentially, you can't go below zero on the interest rate. Well, you can, but that's another.
And they're paying us to take loans.
yes. Well, you know, we resisted going to negative interest rates. But so the Fed said, okay, we're going to actually put more reserves in banks' balance sheet of commercial banks, so they'll have more reserves to lend. And so what it did, it bought some bonds, and it actually paid for these with money and just created out of nothing from an account. It just wrote the figures into the account. Okay, here's the money we just created in this account. And so the idea, again, is to put more reserves into the commercial banking system so the commercial banks will have more reserves to lend. Now, the special program of stimulating the economy, or trying to stimulate the economy through buying bonds based on money that was created out of nothing, is called quantitative easing. Okay, they don't call it printing money for obvious PR reasons. they prefer not to call it the bad thing that it really is. So there were three rounds of quantitative easing. The first round didn't work. So the bank, the Fed says, we're going to do it again. And they actually did three rounds of quantitative easing. And the bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, more than tripled its balance sheet, the liabilities that it had on its balance sheet. Now, we'll say, well, okay, so what? Well, when you have dollars circulating through the economy, these dollars are known as the money supply. When you expand the money supply based on nothing more than writing numbers into an account, you haven't actually created anything of value. And so the existing dollars in circulation, when you add more to them, it's like a stock watering scheme. They're worth less. You know, if you say if you double the number of shares that a company has issued, but you don't add anything to the value of that company, then all the existing shares would actually drop to one half their previous market level. So what this does, it creates powerful forces that are the, I call it the foundation of inflation. We may not be seeing inflation from that. I was expecting that we would, but we didn't. We haven't seen it so far. So many economists said, oh, well, you know, it's a big nothing. It's a bit, not a big deal. Now, my take on quantitative easing is that it is never a good thing, in my humble opinion, to give a group of unelected, just, you know, government-appointed central bankers the authority to create money out of nothing in a, you know, well-intentioned but apparently not well-working program to expand the money supply and therefore expand the economy. Now, why didn't quantitative easing work? I mean, it may have worked a little bit. We're not exactly sure because we can't go back and say, okay, let's do a controlled experiment and see what the economy would have done without quantitative easing. But, you know, as the best that everybody can tell, QE or quantitative easing didn't work very well at all. So we wound up why didn't it work? Because the banks were not making more loans as the Fed was trying to get them to do. And the old saying we've heard many, many times, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So the Fed does not have the authority, nor should it have, to make banks, to compel banks to make loans. And the banks were very risk averse, so they didn't make a lot of extra loans. And so
where'd the money go?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, it's still on the balance sheet of the Fed, and the Fed is now, you know, trying to suck that money back out of the economy without creating too many hazardous ripples, because it knows that with all that excess of money flowing around, it could really eventually wind up in too much money chasing too few goods and services, the classic definition of demand pull inflation. So the Fed is quietly trying to pull that money back in and reduce the size of its balance sheet so it won't be there as like a fuel to the fires of inflation if they ever really get going again. Most people today don't remember, most people that I know anyway, don't remember the late 70s and early 80s and the first quarter of 1980. Inflation was roaring along at 14% per year. And, you know, that's way too much. Generally speaking, from 0 to 2% inflation is considered price stability. You don't want more than 2% inflation, because let's say at 2% inflation, say if it went on year after year, the price level would double in 35 years, okay, which is, you know, that's a little much itself. But you don't want more than that, because it's just, you know, it's arbitrarily redistributes incomes and wealth, and we don't need that. Likewise, we don't want the rate of price change to go below zero. We don't want deflation. You think, oh, that'd be great. We get goods and services at lower prices. But deflation is a sign, really, of a very sick economy. And when prices are falling like that, people wait. They postpone purchases in hopes that they're going to get a better price a little later. And it becomes very negative for the economy, and businesses start to go bankrupt and all kinds of bad stuff. So really, the consensus in the profession for the U.S. is that between 0 and 2% inflation is reasonable price stability. And so we're hoping that inflation will stay in that range, below 2%, but above zero. One other thing about zero or less inflation is called the Japanese sickness. Japan is dealing with that, has dealt with it for many, many years, and they just can't seem to get the inflation rate to stay above zero for any extended period of time. All of these things I'm talking about, in my opinion, are good reasons to have an alternative decentralized free market currency that is not expanded or contracted at the whim of a group of central bankers who, you know, in our case, in the U.S. case, the Fed is not actually a government agency per se. It is overseen by presidential appointees who are confirmed by the Senate. You know, so we do need, in my view, a free market currency, decentralized, that is not so-called fiat money, money that is created based on government fiat or decree. Okay? Hopefully.
Right.
Go ahead. Any follow-up, David?
Yeah, so I guess what are some of the reasons why, I don't know, maybe you could point out some of the effects that inflation has had due to the dilution of the money supply, such as, I mean, of course, my easy example is, you know, I used to buy a 5-pound bag of sugar. Now it's a 4-pound bag at the same price.
Oh, okay.
But
go ahead.
People don't seem to really to really catch on to that. And what, I guess, is there a term that you would use to describe that?
Well, there are several ways of looking at it, but, you know, your 4-pound bag of sugar that used to be a 5-pound bag of sugar is a way of actually disguising a price increase. And, you know, these companies that make these consumer products, they know that we are, that consumers are loss averse. That is, we are much more sensitive to a price increase than we are to a decrease in the amount of product in the package. And so instead of increasing prices, companies will, these consumer product makers will actually decrease the amount of product in the package. The, you know, the 6.5-ounce can of tuna is now down to 5 ounces. The other day I saw some six pack of Coca-Cola that looked a little funny, and I looked at the content, and it was a 10.5-ounce can instead of a 12-ounce can. So we are seeing this. but, you know, the main reason we resist inflation is that inflation brings great uncertainty. And, you know, financial markets, stock markets, if there's anything that they, you know, whatever they hate worst, probably they hate uncertainty worse than anything. Inflation brings uncertainty. The consumer doesn't know what they're going to get charged the next time they buy the product. The sellers of the product don't know what to charge for the product, and they do, you know, can resort to subterfuge, like reducing the amount of product in the package. And so also inflation creates winners and losers. There are people whose incomes can go up just as fast or faster than prices go up, and so they win at the expense of people whose incomes are fixed. Their, you know, nominal incomes are unadjusted dollars. Incomes are fixed, and so when inflation unacceptable inflation occurs, then the purchasing power of the dollars they have goes down. And so, you know, inflation, again, is we see that it arbitrarily redistributes incomes and wealth. When incomes and wealth are redistributed, they should be, this redistribution should be based on the creation of market value somewhere. You know, people doing productive work that is sold for a good price, and then they're paid according to the value of the goods and services they produce. That should be the method of just distributing incomes and wealth in a market economy, not some sort of runaway escapade of prices. Go ahead.
Okay. So basically, for, let's say, the average working Joe who's been at their job for 12 years getting a 3% raise every year, they're not really all that better off, in some cases maybe worse off than they were when they started, correct?
Exactly. And, you know, let's leave the tax consequences aside just a minute. Let's say that prices rise 3% and you get a 3% raise. Well, your real income has changed by 0%. And then, you know, with our tax system the way it is, those additional dollars that you get are likely to be taxed at a higher rate. And so, you know, when you bring back in the tax consequences, in real terms, your income may actually have fallen. If you're, you know, in a 3% inflation environment and a 3% cost of living adjustment, the buying power on what you have left after taxes is going to be a little less, even in purchasing power terms.
Gotcha. All right. Well, that kind of explains where I would say a lot of people feel they are today, you know. Right.
Yeah. Well. Another thing I'm always emphasizing in my classes, and that is that the only way to raise the real wage is through increased labor productivity. That is, companies have to find ways to increase the output per unit of labor input that they get from what they're making. And when, you know, when they do this, if a company says, okay, between January 1 of last year and December 31 of last year, we got 3% more output per unit of labor input, then they could actually pay workers 3% more without adding to their labor cost. So, you know, in order to actually increase the real wage received by workers, labor productivity has to go up. Labor productivity has not been rising near as fast as the rate of inflation over the past couple decades, and so the real wage has been pretty much stagnant. And it's not because the American worker isn't working hard. They're working just as hard, if not harder, than they ever did. It's because companies have been overregulated, overtaxed, and they've not been given incentives to increase the productivity of the labor that they're using. So, you know, I didn't mean to get off into this, but you brought it up, and it is a good point. when companies are given tax incentives and lower regulations, you know, when it's cost less for them to do what they do, when regulations are lowered, then this will help, and it is helping. It has been helping over the last year and year and a half or so.
All right. So earlier you were talking about a decentralized currency. I'm just going to pick Bitcoin, for example.
Yeah.
When you said that deflation's bad, like for an economy, if the value of the buying power of the currency is increasing, you were saying that can kind of restrict the economy. I mean, right now there's only so many people into Bitcoin, and if it becomes a strong, I mean, okay, right now there's $400 billion in all cryptocurrency at the moment.
Right.
And there's what, like 212 trillion estimated of dollars worth of
assets
being transacted in the world. So
yeah. Yeah.
We're not even to 0.5% of the world's money is in cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
So once more, and I personally believe a lot more money is going to come into cryptocurrency.
Oh, yeah.
Once that occurs and the value of Bitcoin really starts to take off, is that going to have negative effects for let's say, markets that rely on Bitcoin?
Well, it's a very complex thing to look at, David, and the answer to your question, I think, is it remains to be seen, because you know, what is needed is a currency that is readily accepted and exchanged and stores value well, and the ability of Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency to store value remains, in my view, untested. Now, you know, I think our whole concept of what is money is about to change. Okay.
Agreed.
And, you know, but the cryptocurrencies are testing that concept of what is money. And I think it's a good thing. It's time to say, okay, let's see what happens in an economy, in a global economy, let us say, when there is a readily accepted medium of exchange that is not issued by a sovereign government somewhere, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I said deflation is bad for the economy, you know, it's not that, you know, my students say, well, when prices are going down, this causes deflation. No, not really. Okay, prices going down is deflation. Okay, so deflation, falling prices, are the product of something, you know, the product of, let us say, just how do I put it? Too few goods and services. Too few dollars chasing too few goods and services, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
You know, I don't think we can really, at this point, say analogize from deflation in fiat money, fiat currency such as the dollar, the yen, the euro, and cryptocurrencies. Cryptocurrencies, you know, the whole thing is pretty new historically. I mean, they've only been, you know, a factor for about 10 years. And as you say, they are a small, tiny fraction of global assets, if you wish. And so, you know, I don't think we can analogize from inflation and deflation on fiat currencies and the price fluctuations, the large price fluctuations that we're seeing in cryptos right now. So, you know, cryptos are going to evolve. And, you know, my money, whatever currency my money is in, my money is on cryptos eventually becoming the accepted exchange medium, because it's just going to be more advantageous to everybody to use cryptos than to use currency units issued by a sovereign government. I mean, you know, you lose a lot with transactions cost, and anything that reduces transactions cost and does it effectively is going to replace whatever whatever he is causing, you know, is plagued with those high transactions cost. Okay. And that's
right.
That's what cryptos, I think they do. They cut out the middleman and they reduce transactions cost dramatically.
Now, when you say the middleman, you mean banks?
I do. Yes, I do.
Okay. And, I just want to clarify.
And also as some of the TED Talks on Bitcoin, point out, the governments, banks, and other institutions are there primarily to reduce uncertainty. Okay, so if you reduce transactions costs and reduce uncertainty using some vehicle or another, then that vehicle is going to be adopted in as many ways as institutions are able to do so.
Right. Okay. So one of the things that happened this last week at Consensus in New York was somebody from the CFTC got up and basically said, we're still going to regulate. You know, if it's a security, the SEC is going to regulate it. If it's a commodity, then we're going to regulate it. But we don't actually know what these are quite yet. And they're kind of waiting to define how they view all. Currency. Where do you see that going?
Well, that's a very good point, David, because, I mean, the arm of U.S. law can only reach so far. And, you know, essentially they can't, they can't regulate anything that is outside the U.S. borders or its territorial, you know, jurisdiction. So, you know, I think they will try to regulate it. I mean, all these regulatory agencies, they're all very territorial. They want to guard their turf as best they can. And so there are going to be attempts to regulate. And, you know, I think, and you and I have talked about this before, I think it would be a mistake for them to regulate cryptos either as a commodity or as a security, because, you know, because it is essentially free of national borders. And business will go elsewhere. Business is going to go to the part of the world where it is least regulated, because it can on the worldwide web. You know, it can go wherever that it's more advantageous to businesses to to deal in that. So,
right. And so I've long held that, you know, if the SEC is going to continue to see ICOs as securities and require them to meet regulatory compliance in the United States, then all those technology companies are going to take their development elsewhere. And we're actually going to lose all of the money that those companies would potentially generate in our economy. And I'm calling for Silicon Valley to look like Detroit in 10 to 15 years. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
It is very possible. And remember that any sort of government program or action always has hidden costs and unintended consequences. And so, you know, regulating cryptos could have some very bad unintended consequences for the U.S., okay? Mm-hmm. Just pure and simple. And so, you know, I mean, governments are jealous of revenue sources. They're always money hungry, and they're, you know, they're going to tap any revenue sources that they can. I mean, there's this mounting battle to tax transactions across the internet anyway.
Right.
Excuse me. And, you know, so far, the common sense has held on that. But states hate the internet because, you know, online sales, generally speaking, are untaxed. And they're trying to make sure that everybody who buys anything online is going to pay some sort of tax on it that will be collected by, say, the local government. Well, you know, government is going to try to get its sticky fingers on this, and they're going to do it in the name of, oh my God, you know, cryptos are perfect for money laundering and tax evasion, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, we've heard that before. Regulating.
So is cash.
Yeah, I believe it's now called cash that's used to do that. You're right. But we're gonna hear that argument. Oh, we got to regulate it for these reasons, blah blah blah. But the real reason, of course, is governments are always revenue hungry, and they're going to try to get their sticky fingers on any source of revenue that they can, and this certainly includes any activity in cryptos.
Okay. Now, as far as third world countries where there's a lot of people who are unbanked, do you see this hurting them or helping them having a decentralized currency?
Well, I think it can only help so many low-income countries, and I really call them less developed and more developed economies. It's really a continuum, sort of, but, you know, the low-income or less developed countries, generally they have weak or non-existent banking systems. And, you know, I had my students watch a little video called Living on $1, where some college boys went to Peña Blanca, Guatemala, to live for 3 months, and they worked up a system where they live on $1 each per person per day to see what it was like living in extreme poverty like that. And excuse me, they wanted to borrow some money, and they went to a regular commercial bank nearby, and it was ridiculous. You know, the documentation they had to have, and, you know, we need an electricity bill, and we need this and that. Well, heck, how can you produce an electricity bill to document a loan when you don't have electricity in your house? So,
right. You know,
so in many, many countries, the banking system is totally for the formal sector and not for the informal sector. So most of the people from using the regular banks. So we've seen lots of ways to address this spring up. In Kenya, people began to pay each other with cell phone minutes as a little medium of exchange. And then out of this developed M-Pesa, mobile money.
I've used it.
Used M-Pesa. Okay. So why is there M-Pesa? Well, because the banking system is not adequate. It has failed to meet the needs of the, you know, the ordinary person in that country. And so cryptos are going to fall right in there. They're going to be used, I'm sure, by people who don't have any other medium of exchange available to them, say, like through regular bank. So mm-hmm. I think there's huge potential there for cryptos to be used as a medium of exchange by, you know, everybody, including the very poor farmer in Ethiopia or wherever.
All right. So lately there's been a lot of news stories that have been less than positive about different cryptocurrencies. And, you know, I mean, in the crypto community, everybody calls it FUD. It's spreading fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Yes.
But, you know, and at the same time, you've got IBM working with Walmart on a pilot project to launch a blockchain for tracking produce from farm to table. You've got NASDAQ, who's come out and said that they're getting involved in blockchain and how it, they put up an ad that it's going to create fast and secure transactions. And, you know, Morgan Stanley reportedly is in talks with GDAX to provide crypto assets to their clients. And JP Morgan is involved with the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance. You got all of these big names. I mean, you just look at the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance and you got UBS, MasterCard, Scotiabank, Credit Suisse, ING. I mean, you name it. It's like, it's a hodgepodge of British Petroleum and Shell are both part of the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance. And so to me, it seems like these are flashing signs that cryptocurrency is about to just explode. And yet people are like, oh, Bitcoin fell $200 today. It's crashing. And I'm like, no, you know, but I mean, as far as from your perspective, why is it that you think there's so many negative news stories out there when there's so much large action from these big players?
The negative news stories are there to sell newspapers to get ratings. And any new technology like this is going to have its speed bumps. Okay, I mean, you're a little young for this, but there was a time when computers couldn't talk to each other. Every computer had its own operating system. And, you know, so finally, Microsoft sort of got the upper hand there with MS-DOS and then later on, you know, Microsoft Office Suite. And it sort of became the industry standard. So we're in the early days here when all these new things are happening and things are really just beginning to sort out. So, you know, don't think that it's one day and maybe sooner than you think. As the guy said last week, one of the people said recently that in 5 years you go buy a cup of coffee at Starbucks, they'll laugh at you if you offer them dollars, because they'll be selling the coffee in cryptocurrency. Now, I don't know if it's going to be 5 years, but that short. But, you know, these
Well, are- I mean, when I go into Starbucks, I don't even pay with a credit card or cash anymore. I just open up their app and scan my code on my phone, and I get my coffee.
Right, and then it automatically debits your account right then and there, right?
Right, but my Starbucks account is in no way near as secure as a cryptocurrency wallet, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, sure. But see, we're evolving. You might even say we're in a revolution now. Sometimes when a revolution is happening, we're so close to it, we don't even recognize that it's happening until we look back and say, oh, that was a revolution we were in. And so, you know, it's evolving so quickly, it could even be perhaps referred to as a revolution that's going on as we speak. And blockchain and cryptocurrencies are driving it, reducing cost, increasing efficiency, increasing the value of service. You know, all these things are driving it.
Mm-hmm.
So did that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, okay. What I've tried to explain to people that don't seem to understand cryptocurrency and why, you know, what kind of value it brings is the security aspect. Like, I've had my credit card skimmed at the gas pump at least 3 times in the last 5 years. And then I have to go back and, you know, cancel any kind of automatic payments I have set up on it and change everything over my, you know, it's a pain.
Oh, yeah.
But while it's a pain to me, it's a huge expense to companies like, you know, Home Depot. They had 56 million credit cards hacked, and it cost them $320 million. And
right.
Those chargebacks and stuff that happen when there's fraudulent charges,
precisely. You know,
yeah. That all adds up, and I just wish I could walk up to the gas pump, scan a code, and send it from my phone. And what I'm excited about is Foxconn and several other phone manufacturers are actually looking at integrating digital hardware wallets into their phones.
Oh, yeah.
Once they do that, you're no longer talking about a software layer that's holding your crypto. Now you're dealing with an actual digital hardware wallet that interacts with the blockchain, and I find that really exciting because that'll basically enable mobile payments right then and there.
You betcha. Yeah.
And so what I kind of wonder, because Apple is so secretive about their development, is this on their radar? I wish I knew, because, you know, we saw what happened with Blockbuster and Netflix. Blockbuster basically boasted that Netflix would never be a threat.
Right.
And
there, yeah.
Their history. So it's, you know, it's kind of like, I feel like putting on classes for businesses to tell them you need to pay attention to moving technologies, because if you're resistant to change and accepting new technologies, you may not be here in a couple of years.
Oh, yeah. I think most businesses that have, you know, forward-looking leadership, et cetera, are working on this. They may not yell and scream about it a lot, but I believe in, you know, somewhere in those companies, they have people saying, okay, how can we use this to do better and survive, if you will, in the next the new environment that this is going to create.
Right. So for somebody who's looking at getting into cryptocurrency today, I mean, let's say that right now, you know, on CoinMarketCap, they refer to the total value of all cryptocurrencies as the market cap of cryptocurrency, right. Which I know some people hate using that term that way, but right now it's, you know, 400 billion. If I were to buy Bitcoin today and then the market cap of crypto goes up to 3.5 trillion.
Yeah.
I would think I would be better off. Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing is, you know, cryptocurrency purchases are so speculative, and please don't anyone, you know, bet the farm, sell the farm and put it all.
Oh no, absolutely not.
Put, you know, limit your total asset holding to, you know, 5% or less in cryptos. But that said, you know, I think the wise investor is going to have cryptos as a part of their overall balanced portfolio. It's I think it's going to go up. There's no guarantees, but I believe it's the future, in my humble opinion.
Yeah. Well, I make a practice especially when broadcasting on YouTube or on a podcast, to never say, hey, I think this one or that one, or hey, this project is really going to do well, because I'm not here to give financial advice. Right. And I'm certainly, you know, not going to go down that road, especially if the SEC is extremely motivated to go after people who might be construed as selling unlicensed securities and such. So,
right.
But just generally speaking, you know, I would just, and I know this is a huge stretch, and you're talking about a crystal ball that doesn't exist, but
right.
Assuming that cryptocurrency payments become something pretty normal in the next 5 years,
right?
What percentage of the world's money do you think might get into cryptocurrency?
Oh, I think potentially 50%, and maybe more.
50% of the world's currency.
Yeah.
That would be huge.
Yeah. It would be. It would be huge.
In 5 years?
And so, I don't know, David, how long it's going to take. When I took my first management course in 1970, they were saying the cashless checkless society is right around the corner. And, you know, here we are, what, a half century later, and we still have people saying they'll get my checkbook when they pry my cold dead hands off of it. Money holding behavior changes very, very slowly.
Right.
But we live in a different time now, and it could be that this money holding behavior is going to change faster than that. But setting a 5-year or 10-year benchmark on it would be so speculative that I would be hesitant to do that.
No, I understand that. I just wanted to get kind of your gut feeling on it. I mean, I know I would say they're older people that they only do cash or check, and they don't even believe in having credit cards or debit cards. So,
right.
You know, I get that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there are also people, maybe still people alive, who believe that the whole moon landing was staged as well. So,
well, there's flat earthers, but I don't listen to that either.
That's good. the evidence to the contrary is overwhelming.
Right? Well, is there anything else about cryptocurrency that you want to bring up while I got you on the line?
Well, we're not going to get bored as we watch this revolution and its technological change and the adoption of these, the blockchain that enables the cryptocurrency, its use cases to many other uses other than just for cryptos. That is happening at blinding speed. So, you know, just as you say, fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be a wild ride, and mostly good, you know, probably all good.
Yeah. I mean, I could actually see a little bit of wealth distribution coming along with this crypto revolution, quite frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. Wealth creation is not a zero sum game. So the wealth creators are going to, really make out in this new economy, as they always have. You know, whatever economy we had. And so I think a lot of wealth is going to be created by this cost reduction, efficiency enhancement that we're going to get from the use of cryptocurrencies and the use of blockchain to enable the use of cryptocurrencies, as well as to enhance many, many other use cases that are now being tested and talked about.
All right. Well, I certainly appreciate your time, and thanks for lending some of your expertise for people who probably don't even really know anything about QE and what it means to the economy. But, you know, I really wish that the Fed would just say, hey, we want to bolster the economy, so we're going to give Dave a couple million on the balance sheet and let him spur the economy, because I'd be more than willing to step up to the challenge of, you know, giving the local economy here a little boost. So, but unfortunately, it just kind of sounds like banks end up always winning in these situations, which is why personally, I think a lot of people are excited about being able to exchange value without having to use intermediaries, quite frankly.
Oh, yeah. And the banks are, you know, they're frantically trying to find ways to avoid being cut out of the loop on this, as well they should, because, you know, their very survival as institutions could be at stake here.
Yeah. Agreed. All right. Well, thanks. And, you know, maybe we can do this again sometime.
I'd love to. It was my pleasure. Have a great evening.
All right.
David.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So you just heard from my father, Dr. Roger Moorfield from the University of St. Thomas. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. You can find me on my website at learntobuycryptocurrency.com. I also have a Facebook page, Learn to Buy Cryptocurrency. And you can message me through either of those avenues and, you know, ask your question. I'd love to address it in a future episode. If I don't know the answer, then I will look into it and see what kind of answer we can come up with. So thank you for joining us. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion about quantitative easing, the economy, and cryptocurrency.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.